Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Everyday Anarchism. I'm your host, Graham Culbertson, and we are back today with Robin Schuldenfrei talking about Bauhaus again. Robin, thank you for coming back on the show.
Delighted to be here.
So we already recorded one episode on Bauhaus, and we did it out of order because I found out about your work through your newest book, which is in some ways a sequel to your first book. But we did that one because that was the new one. But now we're going back in time, both time in your career and also back in time to when Bauhaus was a German thing, as opposed to the second book, which is when Bauhaus is an exile thing. So now tell us about this book. I've got it right here, Luxury and Modernism, and how it fits into what we want to talk about.
Right. Thank you so much. So if my new book, Objects in Exile, is about kind of the way in which a number of designers moved from Europe to the UK and the US and other places in diaspora, Luxury and Modernism is where the story really starts, because I'm really interested in objects, the history of objects, and the way they intersect with capitalism and consumption and what the meaning of objects might be, and how we might understand design and architecture, spaces in which people work together, live together, kind of the impact of objects and spaces, and how that might also interact with political agency. And so really to look in a kind of period culture and understand that period and the people better through the things that they surround themselves with. The Bauhaus really works well for thinking about that and thinking about everyday anarchy, because it's this particular moment in time. Just to wind back the beginnings of the Bauhaus, because I think we might as well start in 1919, the end of World War I. Germany has not known it was going to lose, and then had suddenly lost the control of what was actually happening in the battlefield. The media was very much controlled. And so it was a real moment of reflection and a real moment of what are the implications of machines, of machine production. Because prior to World War II, architects, designers, they were so excited about the possibility of the machine. Okay, William Morris's ideas of doing everything and sort of handcrafted, beautiful objects, that project was understood as a good one, but it in many ways failed. But could that ethos of training up designers be reinvented in such a way that in art schools and design schools, designers may produce really well-designed, beautiful objects for the machine and maybe be produced in a more ethical manner. And so the Bauhaus really springs from this moment in time in 1919. Walter Gropius, a Werkbund member, the Werkbund being this group of German designers and architects and actually capitalists and manufacturers and government officials. Gropius had been involved with this group, and the school gave him a chance to kind of put some of these ideas into practice. The kind of ideas of kind of the social implication of machine production, whether artistic ideas could be made a sort of a prototype, and then maybe manufacturers could produce them at a scale where everybody could then enjoy them. And that was really the sticking point for William Morris. William Morris then turns to politics to try to solve this problem. The Bauhaus wanted to educate in a new way and perhaps be more successful than Morris. And so in three different sites and iterations, first in Weimar, then they get kicked out of Weimar for being too radical, and moved to Dessau. There they really set up a proper school building, a series of master's houses in a sort of lovely pine forest. A dormitory for the students are also connected to the main school building. And then eventually the Nazis come to power, and they are closed down in Dessau and moved to Berlin. So we've got a school in sort of three different sites and three different iterations. And really, I think one of the ways in which we can understand the Bauhaus as a practice of everyday anarchism is really thinking about how can we work together towards a better future. That was really a question that the students had in a really collaborative manner. while the school's pedagogical practices were also really different, much less hierarchical, very untraditional in both new methods of creativity, of child rearing, of getting along with one another, and really kind of breaking things back to basics. Even just the primary colors that end up representing the school, you know, red, yellow, blue, gets back to these kind of building blocks, and thinking about maybe building blocks of society and how we might, with objects all the way towards architecture and the spaces we inhabit, all the way to the city, might sort of create a new future. So that's sort of the start of things. At the same time, what does it mean to be working together as a community? I think that's really important for everyday anarchism as well. How can you kind of address needs? But we also see in the Bauhaus this kind of joy in making. The photography is amazing, both formal photography, which took a long time to be recognized as an art form, but also just being creative. You know, the jazz band at night, those pictures are really amazing. The parties they had. What is the everyday practice of having fun? I think our period right now is so serious. Our future can be so dire. It was really hard then too, but I think they kind of took that moment to work together and to come together. But I think it's also really important to understand the period. It's not just those at the Bauhaus. Hermann Muthesius was a diplomat, also a German designer and architect, and he had gone to England to study their manufacturing and factories and really promoted the arts and crafts back in Germany. And he talked about designing from the sofa cushion to the urban plan. So you can see the reach of the thing. It's a huge scale, right? But it's important, right? The sofa cushion is also important. That for me has always been a kind of touchstone for thinking about this kind of, these kind of interiors. So at the Bauhaus, if you were going to design a chair, it's not just you working in your own little space, you know, your room at night. It's really working in these creative workshops where you could see what other people are doing and what materials they're using. And you might be making your chair in wooden slats, which are then spanned with fabric being woven experimentally in the weaving workshop. So you're working with your colleagues there. Or maybe you want to have a metal, a cantilevered chair, a completely new kind of chair. Then you would be working in the metal workshop and need a different kind of spanning over the metal for the actual part where you sit on or where your back rests. And so really, the people at the Bauhaus really saw their objects as having meaning for society, as well as being really beautiful and really useful. But if you think about for a minute the kinds of objects we might be familiar with at the Bauhaus, the little diminutive silver teapot, or they had these objects they called tea eggs, where instead of making tea in a pot for everybody, everybody would have their own individual silver tea egg, and you would put the amount of tea, the strength of tea you would like for your own cup of tea, in this little beautiful spherical metal ball attached to a kind of metal stick. And, you know, it's basically a metal tea bag. They also made chess sets, a luxury version in, you know, walnut and a more common version in more common woods. But what is the common denominator of all of these objects? Tea, chess, tea eggs. They're all luxury objects, really. So one of the main questions of my book about luxury and modernism is the way in which these objects are being sold, introduced to a wider public, and some of the reasons they might have failed. And I think one of the important aspects of that is the nature of capitalism, the nature of objects. A fundamental question one might ask is, why are there no Bauhaus forks?
So why are there no Bauhaus forks?
I think they were really interested in, well, I don't have a perfect answer to that. I think there ought to have been Bauhaus forks. I think it was an oversight, but it also shows how deeply they're embedded in traditions and these ideas of design objects, right? A good assessment for your, you know, end diploma at the Bauhaus is a beautiful, perfectly spherical, geometric, tea, you know, small teapot. And so this also nods to how the Bauhaus failed. It certainly didn't fail as an idea. It did not fail as a pedagogical model. We see other kinds of schools and, in fact, new Bauhauses spring up later in Chicago with the new Bauhaus. We see Ulm in Germany after the war and many, many, many other schools in many countries propagating the ideas of the Bauhaus in terms of fundamental basic training and these kinds of ideas. But definitely the Bauhaus failed in terms of capitalism. In terms of industrialists who did not want to actually produce the lights that they designed, and consumers who did not want to consume the lights they designed. So you've got a problem, right there on both sides. The everyday person considered it sort of dentist furniture in the period. So you've got objects that are kind of so stripped down that they're really elite and they're beautiful to us, right? That perfect glass lamp that shows the wires, the transparency, the it glowing. They also had really beautiful technological research into the quality of the lights, the way that the tone of the lights, I guess, the luminescence of them. So they're really beautiful objects. But the discourse was also elite too, right? This kind of stripped back modernism, undecorated, stripped back to its elements. And so you basically have the same problem as William Morris. The objects remained elite. They remained outside the realm of the average person. And the Bauhaus was perpetually in need of funds. You know, Gropius would write, "Can you help me find capitalists?" to his affluent friends. They were really didn't understand capitalism enough to make it work for them, but also realized they needed that kind of income to make the school work.
Okay. I want to make sure we spend some time talking about pedagogy, but before we do that, let's spend a little bit more time with Morris. So again, and this will be anyone who's listened to the Morris episode with Ruth Kenna, this will be a repeat, but also that episode came out in like 2022 or something. So we're talking about a while ago. Morris sets out to make these beautiful things, and aesthetically they're very unlike the Bauhaus. They're not stripped down. They're very decorative and ornamental. They're very anti-Christopher Wren. And then he can't make them at a price that regular people can purchase them because of capitalism. So Morris decides, well, then I'm a socialist now, because the answer has to be that we can make beautiful things for normal people. And capitalism says, sure, you can make beautiful things, but just for rich people. So hence socialism. Bauhaus has a just absolute get out of jail free card on this called technological reproducibility. They can make beautiful things, but it doesn't have to be William Morris or Hart Crane or whoever slaving over each individual thing and making it perfect. They can make a beautiful Bauhaus design and then, you know, make a machine that can make that teapot, and then they can make a ton of them. Except they don't. This doesn't happen. And it turns out that these Bauhaus objects that we admire that look like they might have been made by a machine probably actually took a lot more time than the Morris things that were meant to look like they were made by hand. So is this just like they didn't get enough capital, or Hitler came along before? I mean, how did this Bauhaus, which seems like with technological reproducibility could have solved the Morris problem, how did they end up honestly worse than Morris in terms of being able to be delivered to the people?
Yeah, I think I think you make a really great point on this, and it's exactly this problem. So Germany in 1919, in this period, it is industrializing, but the products coming out of Germany are known as billig and schlecht, which translates to cheap and nasty, right? So it is the kind of made in Vietnam as an earlier period, and made in China before China made all of our iPhones, in that kind of iteration. So they're trying to come up out of this cheap mass production kind of culture. And how do you change a culture of consumption? I think that's a really good question for this time period in Germany and this time period in the era of climate crisis. It's a good question for us today too, right? And so really this idea of having taste of the well-designed object, if you could just get that perfectly designed object and then mass produce it and then widely distribute it, you would be all set. Now think back to where people bought things in this period. They bought them in small shops in the city, small, really crowded little mom and pop shops. Problem there is they don't even have prices on the objects. You have to go in and haggle every time you want to buy something. And then they look at your clothes and then they decide what your price is, or your, we know somebody, then it's a different price. You've got a kind of bizarre marketplace, kind of, flea market type economic infrastructure there. And then you have the rise of the department store. That's a really good way of selling objects inexpensively in large quantities. And in Berlin, and of course in Paris, London, in the US, you get these beautiful, incredibly historicist in terms of style department stores just filled to the gills with these rows and piles of amazing objects. But those things are also meant to cater to the average person. Somebody wants to now buy a handkerchief, it'll be a cheap fixed price. In fact, artificially low to turn the mom and pop store out of business, right? You go in and get them in there with the cheap, stiff white collar or the handkerchief, and then maybe they'll buy something else. And department stores didn't want to sell abstract handmade teapots from the Bauhaus. I mean, the incredible Mariana Brandt little diminutive teapot, which has this amazing cross base and this perfectly half spherical shape. It's silvered. It has an ebony wood, half circle, handle. And this is not the kind of object you can scale up. You might have been able to scale it up in maybe nickel or silver plating. But again, the factory owners weren't interested in retooling, because what do people want once they can afford a teapot? They want something with some ornate fake Rococo or maybe some fake classicism. So again, you have this problem of manufacturing, but you also have this problem of taste. And there's a certain way in which that continues to perpetuate itself. Children's toys as well. The Bauhaus made incredibly, really creative toys. So again, just to touch back into the pedagogy, how do we actually train up also in the next generation with really creative toys rather than prescriptive toys? You know, there's one way to play with this tiny sailboat. How about a shipbuilding toy full of half circles that can be the base or it can be the sail? You have to put it back in the box in a certain way. The shipbuilding toy was an amazing kind of all handmade out of wood. And in fact, the toys were one of the aspects that sold well at the Bauhaus. Parents were willing to shell out and they could make them out of wood cheaply enough. And actually, they would sometimes pay the students to make extra, right, that they could actually sell the toys. And so some students, you know, had more money, pocket money, basically, because they were doing extra overtime on the toy production end of things. But you basically do have a problem of taste, capitalism, production, distribution, all the classic problems.
Yeah, and then, you know, there's more color in the 50s and 60s, but is it too far to suggest that, you know, if you get like an old 1962 edition of Life magazine and flip through it and you look at the cars and the furniture and the ovens and the, you know, there's all these scenes of home and women bringing a cocktail to the husband who's sitting on this, you know, probably not a Le Corbusier couch, but it's probably descended from a Le Corbusier couch. So is it that the Bauhaus, the design ethos sort of finds its place as a mass culture, but it's the 50s and 60s, and then it's no longer any attempt at social transformation has changed, but just Life magazine has convinced people that sleek modern design, which is now 30 years old, is cool. And because of American imperialism, people can actually afford sleek modern design in Detroit in 1962 in a way they could not afford sleek, modern design in Dessau in 1924.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point. So the Bauhaus patents remain, and Ludwig Mies van der Rohe, as the last director of the Bauhaus, gets to keep the patents for the Wassily chair and a lot of the objects. And also the individual designers kept them as well, as much as they could as well. And those get sold on by Tonet, Knoll, these kind of manufacturers. And Bauhaus reproductions, officially sanctioned reproductions, remain expensive all the way through. But you're right, there is a kind of trickle-down modernism, and also well-designed modernism. So Charles and Ray Eames in the post-war period, as the post-war American economy, especially because it is, you know, the only man standing after World War II, its factories have not been bombed to smithereens, they're able to retool back from war industry objects to objects for all of the returning GIs who are marrying their sweethearts and buying new houses. The housing crisis meant that houses were being certainly mass produced, the ranch house, the Levittown houses, and people had a whole range of objects. And it's at that point where there's enough of a critical mass in magazines like definitely Time and Life, and of course all the proper, you know, shelter design magazines, you know, House and Home and House Beautiful, and you get all that kind of LA style with, you know, the house cantilevered out with the glass and the woman sitting in the perfect 50s dress with her cocktail looking out over in the perfect modern, singular modern chair. You certainly get a whole range of the chemical industry creating those aquas and turquoises and red, and that you would make your mark on your house as different than your neighbor's otherwise identical house by having an interior that was, you know, one set of color scheme. And that gives way eventually to, you know, the pink bathrooms and the olive appliances and these kinds of things. Part of those colors is also planned obsolescence, right? It's capitalism working its way through the system again, because the aqua and pale pink bathrooms are out, and then the kind of olives and browns of the 70s, and then you get the 80s with a whole kind of postmodern lemon kind of palette. And so, yes, we can see the way in which modern design and the idea of good taste can somehow be broadened and distributed. And I'm not sure that we then still have the meaning of the objects that were produced in the Bauhaus in that period. This idea of kind of social change through your objects, through surrounding yourself by beautiful objects, right back to Morris, right? I don't want to be around anything that I do not know to be beautiful or useful. And certainly in the post-war American economy and in the European economy to follow, it's about consumption, resurrecting economies quickly by surrounding yourselves with objects. Then you get things like storage walls from Herman Miller. And it's the advertisements, of course, the advertisements are amazing because it's the cupboard just spilling with tennis rackets and golf clubs and other kind of sporting equipment and roller skates and skateboards and board games and hobbies, right? Hobbies to keep people busy, but you consume things for hobbies. Hobbies are rarely something that you just do intrinsically, right? You need crochet needles and electric train cars. And, you know, it's a very expensive hobby, right? To do model electric cars. And so, yes, there's a way in which modernism gets picked up by capitalism that's very far from the Bauhaus origins. And yet the Bauhaus is in many ways a reproducible experiment, right? This idea that everyday designers get up and go to work to design a better object, something that functions better, looks better, to envision a better world. And so it's kind of a portable idea through time as well as geography and history and place. And you have a lot of parallels, I think, to the present moment with the uncertainty and drama and sort of great pain of World War I and the suffering of people being gassed, amputees, death and destruction also to the environment, the kind of interwar excitement and exuberance, but also the crash and the U.S. Depression, which of course sets off a global recession and depression, and unstable politics, the rise of the right wing. And how does history, how does design fit into those circumstances? Why, when Gropius could have done anything, does he devote all this energy to a school? Also the thinkers, the people who are attracted to this school, they literally saw pamphlets and walked there, some of them in their military uniform because they didn't have like civilian clothes at that point. So I think it's really interesting to think about the Bauhaus. It was just in existence from 1919 to 1933, 14 short years. And yet all of this creativity, all of this idea for the future, all this idea of how we could maybe manufacture and improve people's lives really comes together. And that, for me, again, in thinking about how everyday anarchy, how like a collaborative creativity, what that intersection might look like. The Bauhaus tried not to get too involved in politics. It was trying to do things, but I would argue that its objects are political, even the ones that failed. There's a way, there's a reflectivity in these objects, in these shiny objects, right? It's sort of, you understand people as being part of it, but also that we can have fewer, better, more longer lasting objects in our lives, that we can choose to surround ourselves with these kinds of objects, that design is in many ways a kind of conscious choice. And I think the Bauhaus taught us to think about the objects that we choose to make, even if we fail. And I think also William Morris and his What Leads to Politics, also, even if we don't own William Morris objects, we think about the objects we have because we know about Morris. There is a political implication even before he gets into politics in these objects. But also not buying, right, is also a choice. It's also a way of being, right, to not consume. And that happened in the Bauhaus period. And of course, that happens as a political movement now. And so I think the lesson of the Bauhaus is in many ways the portability of its essential ideas and not its failure and its implication with capitalism, even though that's my research, you know, showing the way these materials were luxurious, this ideology was luxurious. It in many ways failed. And so my research in a lot of ways is critical of the project. And yet, I think the importance of the project can't be underestimated, in that the Bauhaus remains part of syllabi and a kind of a common word that people know, even if they don't know too much about the school or the movement. I think that's important.
So another way, and this will take us into education, but backwards, another way to think about this failure is, you know, Yanis Varoufakis in his most recent book writes a lot about Don Draper and this period where modern design was ascendant in the United States. There was another very powerful group, right? I mean, I mentioned Life magazine, and that was a form of, we could call it, bourgeois education of taste, right? Like, you might have grown up loving William Morris, and maybe you're imagining a living room just filled with handcrafted bric-a-brac. But once you open that Life magazine, you learn that that's not supposed to be the living room that you want. You, as a middle-class ascendant consumer, want a different living room that is a descendant of modernist design. So I'm wondering if this is another way, and again, history is catastrophically interrupted, first by the Depression, and then, of course, by Nazism, World War II, and the Holocaust. If this is just like, you know, modernism had an image problem in the 30s, and if you were a post-World War I working class member of German society, you didn't aspire necessarily to have the newest and latest stuff in the way that a working class person in 1957 in the United States might aspire to demonstrate their modernity as instructed by tasteful magazines. I don't know if I'm still taking us too far away from where we need to go, but I'm trying to put it together for myself.
Yeah, I think that's important. but you had to fill your house with something, right? And you wanted to demonstrate, and also that the manufacturing industry in and of itself created wealth, because if you just had a high school degree or just came back from Europe from serving the military, you could have a good wage and have a lot of spending power. And the dollar was strong. And so you could buy things, and you're also producing the things that you're going to buy. So you're working in the Schwinn bicycle factory, going home to your tracked home in, you know, the Chicago suburbs in your car, which is also being produced just in Detroit, also affordably. And so it all just keeps spiraling and spiraling and spiraling until it doesn't anymore, until we have the, you know, the fuel crisis in the 70s, and we have the 1960s movements with all of the disparity between African Americans and white America, and other sort of political moments where, you know, I thought this might lead to the Back to the Land movement and the Whole Earth Catalog, and that all. So it reaches a certain point, and then people say, stop, you get Woodstock. So I think we have these cultural moments, and I think it's really interesting to think about how we get from Tupperware to, you know, wax wrapping our sandwiches, right? Because these are objects. And how was Tupperware sold? I mean, Tupperware, first of all, is part of the kind of oil industry, the sort of flexible ability of that plastic, the colors of it, the way it was sold, not sold in any stores. You were just sold to your neighbors, right? You have Tupperware parties. So social interaction in a kind of otherwise anonymous suburb became important. And just the amount of Tupperware, the different kinds that you would need, the Tupperware popsicle makers, and all of the kind of different salad holders and the cake, you know, to bring your cake to a party, cake transporter in Tupperware, these kinds of objects. So I think Tupperware is probably a great example of, you know, how this can play itself out. Also, where does culture kind of like cultural capital come from? You have the Museum of Modern Art in New York with its annual objects under $10. So they too would be arbiters of taste. And here are, you know, right around Christmas, they would always have this show, which was hugely popular. These objects under $10, you could go find out what the most tasteful that maybe you hadn't noticed yourself, objects under $10 might be. And so the idea that this is no longer elite, right? And that comes back to my book about luxury and modernism in the pre-World War II period, it has to be that now everybody can afford it for it to sort of be successful in that way. But, you know, in a way also it becomes a victim of its own success, right? Things just sort of spin out. So they're no longer, they're now modernistic rather than pure, the purity of modern. And you also have a lot of fun, like Charles and Ray Eames, their objects, you know, their little child's chair with the little heart, or fun big games, multimedia, also using modernism and kind of media history, I think is really interesting here. And that certainly goes back to early Bauhaus pedagogical just assignments, right? Of thinking about, you know, how do you fold paper so it can stand up? How can you think about color and putting color together in new ways and texture? And so kind of segue in a sort of segue to pedagogy, or thinking about how you teach, how are you going to teach the modern citizen? How can art kind of stimulate not only creativity, but activity? And someone like Laszlo Moholy-Nagy, who comes to the, one of the first important teachers of the foundation course at the Bauhaus, this first year course everybody has to take, even if you've graduated from like École des Beaux-Arts. When you come back to the when you come to the Bauhaus, you go back to stage one, no matter what. And there was no taking credits and moving on to stage two. And so you're really breaking down previous training and building people back up. Not breaking down in a bad way. People often burned their previous drawings. They would show up, realize, you know, all their historicist facades or their landscapes, you know, meant nothing, or their history paintings. And so students famously would quite often burn previous work. Or if you see it, it just looks so anachronistic to what they ended up producing at the Bauhaus. And so how do you take people back to the basics? How is kind of coming together in this personal creativity and also this kind of group creativity. And so Johannes Itten was very sort of mystical. He had almost like a cult following, vegetarian diet, a lot of meditation, these kinds of things. Eventually, that kind of mystical early Bauhaus kind of wears itself out, and he leaves, and Laszlo Moholy Nagy is brought in, and he's young, and he's been working with kind of this idea of constructivism and really kind of modern ideas. And he really is thinking about process more than the object, right? So this is more process-based design. And even the idea that, you know, you might start making things by hand, but how can we properly design for a machine? Again, how can we put things into machine production? And so really this idea that design can become a solution to an urgent social or economic problem is also part of their pedagogy there. But Moholy Nagy also has a wonderful kind of pedagogical outlook, which is that everybody is talented. And he really believed it. And I think those of us who are teachers always need to remember this, right? People, everyone is talented. We don't always bring out in our classrooms the talent of everybody because we don't always assign a whole range of tasks and moments for people to show their various talents, which I think is a pity. But I think that's also part of this idea that you can experience different materials, different relationships with the world. And not everything has to be productive for manufacturing. Not everything has to be productive for capitalism. Again, we get into a problem there with the Bauhaus not ever making enough things to pay its bills and keep the doors open and the lights on. It's good, actually, because if you actually have those, you know, glass facades, you don't need much electricity for lights, but at night becomes important. And also when Moholy Nagy is leading the new Bauhaus in Chicago, he runs into exactly the same problem as Gropius, where Gropius was always saying, help me find capitalists to support myself or just at my school. And in Chicago, Moholy was also always trying to keep the lights on and seeking donations from potential patrons. But he's really kind of retooling human perception in the sort of creative process together and creating these kind of new sets of relationships between the viewer and the world and really creating these objects that might be appropriate for new ways of viewing the world. So he had a lot of kind of tactile objects, had the students make things, carve things out of wood that would be smooth or rough or, you know, playing with these kinds of things, how they kind of end up into useful objects in a post-war economy was never quite clear. And definitely the industrialists who supported the new Bauhaus were very disappointed. They thought when they brought Moholy Nagy, you know, direct person involved in the Bauhaus to the new Chicago Bauhaus, that at the end of the school year, you would have, you know, for the final show, lots of like mini telephones and objects that would be really useful, ready for the production lines of Chicago. And of course, you get instead all these really abstract objects, but they're on their way to being ergonomic or useful objects in some way, just not in a perfectly linear fashion.
Okay, that's wonderful. I'm still struck by this idea, you know, this sort of the problem of education. I mean, this isn't a Bauhaus thing. This is a bigger thing. This question that seems more relevant now than ever, which is what is education for? I'm thinking, I don't have the details of why Morris was not interested in starting a school, but it seems in part obvious if you come from a guild artisanal craft tradition, school in the way that your average 21st century person thinks of it as a place where a bunch of kids go, all the kids go to some form of school, and then they are taught the basics really of book learning, of the subjects that were decreed to be part of the medieval university, like arithmetic or the alphabet, as opposed to what, you know, people who didn't go to the medieval university were learning, which was carpentry or farming. So my guess would be, if you come from this medievalist tradition that Morris is in, you don't see school as directly related to craft. And I don't have Ruth Kinna here to ask her if that feels right, but I am curious if there's just some sort of academic or architectural angle that makes the Bauhaus see school as connected to craft in a different way. Because to this day, there is an uneasy relationship between the head and the hand in universities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's a really, really important and quite poignant point. The Bauhaus, even though it was involved in thinking about eventual machine production, really is concerned with craft and training up the craftsman as an individual, really as someone who's going to envision a new world, who's going to work with a community. One of the goals of the Bauhaus was to situate in a factory one of their students. And in a few examples, it worked, right? The idea that Marianne Brandt, the only female metalwork shop student, incredibly talented, incredibly creative as well. And she actually did work for the Candom Light Factory. But the idea would be in a corner area, there would be a kind of workshop where the prototypes and really this kind of artistic goods would be designed for the company. And then the rest of the factory would produce it. And so really, how do you create that person? It's really a lot about not a particular skill set, which we all know technology is always changing all the time. But how do you create a person, prepared for the world, an uncertain and changing world? And I think pedagogically that remains important in art school and also in universities. We're training people to think, especially now with the internet, we can look up anything, and with AI, it can do more and more and more. And so how do we harness that potential of an unknown future? What kind of education of the person? The Bauhaus had an incredible evening lecture series. It's exhausting to just look at who spoke there and when. Somebody finally put together a book with that program. And every night they had incredible new films, science, knowledge, psychology, psychiatry, all sorts of different topics. I never get the sense that people at the Bauhaus were huge readers. We don't have like large libraries. I mean, yes, certainly, but it was really about the kind of creativity and interacting with the world as well. And I think that's also an important part of this kind of training. Again, this kind of, what is the creative energy and the critical mass of being with like-minded people? And I think in any art school, you get that hum and that buzz. People who have been the only really creative person in their small high school get to a place like RISD or Parsons or anywhere, and, you know, get that collaborative and inspiration from being around other talented students. And I think the Bauhaus was really like that. And their pedagogy, their methods fostered that. And again, this Laszlo Moholy-Nagy idea that everyone is talented, but a lot of his students were really talented. And so he got, you know, lots of post-war GIs. And so his school grew and grew and grew. And I think the creativity of that, it eventually becomes, you know, the Institute of Design, and then it gets absorbed by IIT and still exists today in an iteration of that. And so really, I think this idea of producing students and designers, creative people who can go out in the world and carefully put new objects in the world is one of the important legacies of the Bauhaus. And that's the pedagogy more than just the idea of workshops certainly important is this foundation course, this foundational breaking down and building back up to particular fields of expertise. But we don't really need any more stained glass, you know, workers. You know, at a certain point, some of the fields, the ceramicists also didn't go to Dessau. They just stayed in Weimar because that was where their clay was. And, you know, on the banks and things like that. And so even during the course of the Bauhaus, it got more kind of practical and certain kinds of materials. But this kind of larger idea of retooling for human perception, of creativity, of kind of these objects and these kind of new relationships between people and the worlds they're trying to build, even if we don't know what that new world is. And that was the sense. They were always on the cusp of, what are we designing for? Who are we designing for? Even if they got that wrong, kind of tragically wrong. I mean, there's seven. There are seven of these Marianne Brandt teapots. Just seven, which is incredible because they look mass-produced. And when you see them all together, sometimes Bauhaus exhibitions have them all in one case recently, quite memorably. And you can see how they're all really different too. They're all a little bit bigger, smaller. So in no way are they kind of this idea of uniform mass production. These actual Bauhaus objects are quite special and quite unique in their own way. But you don't note that because they look modern to us. So that's part of the success of their aesthetics, I would say.
Yeah. I mean, I don't want to belabor this, but this is just an irony that is just, I mean, just almost beyond belief. The carefully handcrafted pseudo, like that irony does not exist for Morris. You can tell someone did that stuff by hand. At the risk of going somewhere not very useful, and you can just tell me if this is not useful. When you were talking about Bauhaus training, it reminded me of this thing, this hideous thing that I'm very opposed to that is called, quote, like design thinking, which is basically the doctrine that people can be trained in a sort of rote and almost algorithmic way what design is. It seems like maybe design thinking isn't in vogue anymore, but 10 or 20 years ago, it was like everything was like, oh, design thinking. Apple knows design thinking. Are you having trouble in your town with poverty? I bet design thinking can solve poverty. And it sounds like quote, design thinking and the kind of training they're doing at the Bauhaus seem to me pretty opposed, if that makes sense. I don't know if this is a useful thing, if you want to respond to it.
Yeah, no, that's on. Because I've always been allergic to design thinking myself and the books about it. And yeah, thinking through design, because for me, design is this cultural moment that we can understand a period. It's one tool a historian might use. And I've always been drawn to objects. How are they made? Why are they made? How do they exist in capitalism or not? The ideas of consumption. And design thinking flattens all of that yes. out in a really disturbing way. And it's also unsuccessful, right? If it worked, that would be one thing. But I think that gets back to kind of Jane Jacobs or like Hilbersheimer, either way, right? It can be top down or it can be bottom up. But in the end, you need people to connect, to talk about how they relate to one another. What kind of world do you want to build together? Not how we should let design rule our world and control our world, even though, make no mistake, it does, right? I mean, iPhone, it is quite disturbing. No matter how much you push it away, certain ways of thinking do change. Or, you know, when the Mac, you know, came in, the way you think through a Mac. But that's really different, I think, than design thinking. Yeah, I'm fully allergic to it. It's giving me hives right now.
Yeah, I mean it is, and you're right. It's flattening. It's just another version, slightly spruced up with aestheticism, of the sort of Boston Consulting Group idea that there's someone out there who has training you don't have. And oh my God, guys, if you ever look at like what is actually taught by these consultant firms or in MBA classes, it's like there's nothing there.
Yeah.
There's nothing there.
Because there's no people behind them, right? There's no humanism there.
Yes. Yes, because there is no humanism there. That is absolutely true. And it's clear that Bauhaus is a humanism. And that takes us back to the irony, because you might look at those teapots and not see a humanism. Clearly, certain consumers didn't see a humanism. And that makes that makes Bauhaus's triumph, or zombie Bauhaus's triumph in the 30 glorious years in America, is, you know, you needed a new human. You needed a human who wanted to project themselves as part of a Jetsons future of American hegemony and prosperity. And they didn't have those humans in 1921.
Yeah, they weren't lined up in that way, right? And even the graphics of the period, right? You start to get this kind of way of quantifying data in a really amazing way. And some of that sort of starts at the clarity of the Bauhaus. We haven't talked about Bauhaus, like typography, the graphic design of the Bauhaus, which is also the same thing, really simplifying down to blocks of color, to abstraction, but still highly legible. And then the way, that's actually a really successful way of communicating. And post-war graphic design coming out of American art schools is really incredible. But graphic design in Europe also is really, really important. And I would say the legacy of graphic design is important in terms of a success, much more than the teapots. And again, because it's relating to humans, how can we understand, how can we convey something that people can understand quickly, even if they have a short attention span? Laszlo Moholy-Nagy made a series of posters for the London Underground during the war about, you know, during the blackout, be careful when you're getting on and off buses and things because it's all black. And the last thing you want is someone to trip and then, you know, break something. That makes things even worse in wartime. And so how can you, also Herbert Beyer. So how can you design for clear communication and in many ways, a helpful communication, and also in an inspiring way? And I think that gets back to this kind of humanism, this desire to communicate, which is different in different contexts, but part of the kind of radical education of coming together to visualize a different world. Even if that world or that visualization is not something that everyone understood during the period, history is long. And we still remember the Bauhaus. And I think that these lessons are really important.
Okay, one more thing on this, and then I'm just going to let you have the last word. Tell me about, because I meant to talk about this last time and we didn't, the typeface with no capital letters. Because I must admit, I briefly, this is something I haven't talked about yet on the podcast, but like these debates erupt about whether to capitalize things. So the word black now, meaning African American, is capitalized and in lots of places, everywhere in the academy, as near as I can tell. And I was thinking about it, and I mean, I'll just simplify this briefly. This would be a whole episode to do this. It didn't feel right to me to capitalize it for lots of reasons. But I read a defense of capitalizing it, which suggested, you know, we shouldn't capitalize black because it's a real thing. We should capitalize black because it's a made up social category in the same way that Germany is. And I looked at that and I just thought, yeah, I shouldn't be capitalizing black, but I shouldn't be capitalizing Germany either. Actually, like that's actually like the way I made sense of this was not to start capitalizing black, but just to think, yeah, there is a hierarchy of what certain words mean, and some words mean more this. And oh my God, if you know German, to a certain extent, doesn't have this hierarchy because it fucking capitalizes everything. All the nouns. But there's still a categorization there of like, oh, these things are capitalized and these things are not. Yep. So it seems to me that actually, you know, I have a friend who jokes about being anti-capitalist. shout out to Ben, being anti-capitalist and not using capital letters. But it's more than that, I think. But I didn't know if that typeface had this or if it was just supposed to be nice, clear, communicable design.
Yeah, it was all these things. And I think that's really important. And the example of black being capitalized, living in Europe, I saw that just through the New York Times, and then read their explanation of it. And absolutely, the first thing I wanted to know is more, and sorry if early in the podcast I said African-American, I think it was in the context of talking about a period in which one would have said African-American.
You don't have to be on the, you know, I cannot stand Steven Pinker, but he's got this term for the pejorative treadmill, meaning these words that we use and then we're not allowed to use them anymore because the words become offensive because of the negative feeling so many people have. So we're constantly switching what word we use to talk about whether we mean Black people or African American people, but it's switching the word is not the
true. No, but I really am in favor of Black with a capital B. Because I really think that that movement and that the idea, and absolutely in my own writing, that's how I would do it, even if it wouldn't necessarily be the norm here in the UK. And in terms of the capital letters at the Bauhaus, or the lack of capital letters, first of all, is an idea of an efficiency. If you can, you know, with your typewriter, get rid of all the capital letters, it's that much faster. So it's a modern idea. It's modernizing the language. And for a long time, fracture, that really difficult to read handwriting, all the official documents had to be in that, which is a different thing than a typewriter type writing. So you're modernizing first to the typewriter, and then you're modernizing further by getting rid of the extra labor of the superfluous nature of capital letters. And that goes back to something like Out of Lowe's and Ornament and Crime, to get rid of the ornamentation, the extraneous objects, and back to William Morris, the sort of simplicity of things. You know, William Morris complaining that he wants a plain wooden walking stick, not a walking stick that's bulbous and decorated and sort of hideous. And so this is the graphic design equivalent of the pared down minimalist object, or the simple walking stick, or in Out of Lowe's case, the undecorated, he wants to pay his shoemaker more money not to put the decoration in. He just wants the simple thing, right? And so, with that, the idea, and also if it's all lowercase, you know, the A and the O and the D, that particular graphic design just simplifies everything. You get rid of the little serifs, right? The little bits, the curly cues that come off the T, or the I, or this kind of thing. It's part of this simplification and this modernism, which of course people, not everybody liked. And again, it's, showcasing your modernism to have the typewriter with only lowercase letters. I like it for me because it's very hard to read these handwritten letters in fracture in the archive, and then you get to a nice non-capitalized letter, and you can, you know, so easily read these archival documents. But that's an important process of modernization, this kind of idea of simplification.
Okay, wonderful. That was fascinating. All right, we've been talking. So we've been recording for about an hour. We chatted a bit before. We've been talking for, I don't know, probably 50, 55 minutes of recording. So we should be towards the end. What else, what did I forget about or not ask you, or you just want to say while we're here talking about the meaning of Bauhaus and modernism?
I guess as a concluding thought, having spent the better part of an hour kind of rethinking about these objects and what they mean in life, is that it might be an important moment again to think about what objects we want to create, consume, not consume, and how we want to do it with others as an individual decision, and to not put upon others. If other people need to consume to make themselves feel better, I feel sorry for them, but I also respect that. They want to surround themselves with a lot of cozy objects to make their interior world fit with their exterior world, or the way people dress too. I don't think everyone should dress the same. I really like it when people dress in a really individualistic way. And so I think it's an interesting moment to think about how practices at the Bauhaus in the period historically fit over the trajectory of an idea of everyday anarchism, and the way in which people can come together, create something anew, you know, community theater, a new, flea market in their town, or a youth shop. I was just thinking about, as a kind of parting idea, Germany, they have these shops now, which are lending shops. So people donate objects to them. and people borrow from them like you would borrow from a library. So say you need a giant coffee tureen for a birthday party, a large party you're holding. Instead of going out and buying one or trying to figure out from whom you can borrow one of those 1950s, you know, heated coffee tureens or urns, coffee urns, I guess they're called, or power tools, right? I need to drill something once or twice. I really don't want to buy a top of the line drill. And in Germany, you have those like really strong stone walls. You need a special, you need a high quality German drill. And these lending, each city now quite frequently, and they're growing, have these kind of lending shops, which you just have a simple membership. And you can borrow these objects rather than acquire them yourselves. But they also have a community nature to them, right? The people who run them, the way they run them, the other people who tend to use them. And I think that's important too. I think that's maybe also a legacy of thinking about objects and what we need and what we don't need. And I think that that would be my kind of parting thought to reflect upon the thing you think you need to buy and have, and whether you need to do that as an individual consumer, or whether that in fact can be rejected but replaced by something practical.
Yeah, that's wonderful. I had no idea library socialism was going on like that in Germany. I'll have to email the wrong boys immediately and tell them they probably already knew. The only, you know, I said I was gonna let you have the last word, but I have to respond and you can respond. So the only thing is there are objects I'm accumulating now in my house, tons of them, too many of them that I'd never accumulated before. And that is vinyl records, mm-hmm. because the flip side of the, you know, we need to consume fewer things, right? Is this cloud AI streaming world in which you don't get to, I would have probably owned 10 records if there was a record library in my town, which there isn't. But I mean, I don't think that's a thing even.
It used to be, able to lend records from libraries.
Exactly. But honestly, you know, my daughter, sadly, she's 8, but she way prefers graphic novels to actual books. Maybe that's just an 8 thing. I like graphic novels too, but I think you should read both of them. But she'll get into like a series of graphic novels, and I'll be like, I'll just get these from the library, and then I'll look, and they only have them digitally. They're only for an iPad. And talk about objects you don't want in your home. We do not have an iPad in our home. And so then a physical book and a physical record becomes an object you need in your house if there's not a library option, and the only other option is paying the capitalist. So that is the kind of consumption that I am against, but that I am for in this current moment, when the alternative is endless streaming services using who knows how much electricity. I mean, it's not,
and data and storage and Yeah, absolutely. But I think that exactly proves the point of saying you are making a careful decision about what you want to bring into your house. Beautiful vinyl records with an incredible cover. The graphic design is part of it. A carefully composed track list, a B-side. The way it kind of smells, if it's an age part of it, how you're storing it in your house, probably in a place where some people can see it, that's part of it as well. And what you're not consuming, you're not buying your child an iPad. Your bookshelves are probably heaving, as are mine. And so I'm using the library a lot because I just am out of bookshelf space. And IKEA has cheapened their Billy bookshelves. You know, the Billy is what academics live with. I have vintage Billy and would need to find some more vintage Billies, but then that will be a different color. and so the library for me is a lifeblood, but that's exactly the point. You're making a really carefully considered decision about what comes through your door and what doesn't. And that's a different decision from another person who's giving it thought. And I think that's exactly what an archaeologist of your home in 100 years or 1,000 years might encounter, right? And I think that in and of itself is a really poignant point about what technology do we bring back in how those kind of ideas of reproduction that allowed for vinyl then supplanted by lesser quality objects and now maybe more. I'm not enough of a sound engineer. But I think, yeah, I think that's really important. I think that you're making an important decision there. And yeah, I think everybody, I think it's interesting to think about how people do make those decisions.
So David Graeber has a joke that supposedly what was bad about the Soviet Union was that everyone had to stand in line for a long time. And then when they were done standing, they all got the same thing. But when iPhones come out, you'll see people standing in a long line and then they all get the same thing. And so what was supposedly bad about the Soviet Union, we are voluntarily, it seems like, choosing for ourselves in the 21st century. And I don't mean to sound too much like a snob talking about vinyl. I'm also not enough of an audiophile. I'm not one of those people who says vinyl sounds better. It's precisely, I mean, there's cover art that I owned like CDs of when I was buying CDs in the 90s that now that I have some of these on vinyl, I think, oh, I never even really knew what this looked like because the art was so small and now it's beautiful.
Yeah. And it's behind plastic, right? Yeah absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. No, that's a great concluding thought. I'm going to let you have the last word on that.
No. All right. Well, then thank you, Robin, for coming back on the show. This was wonderful.
Yeah, it was really fun.